Support for IPR comes from Corridor Vein Center and Corridor Aesthetics, treatment for varicose veins and spider veins, also providing facial rejuvenation services and treatment for moderate to severe acne. More at Corridor Vein and CorridorAesthetics.com.
It's your Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Joining us today, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, where he's Rosenfield Professor and Professor of Political Science. Hi, Wayne.
Hello, Ben.
Kelly Winfrey joins us as well, political communications scholar at ISU. She's director of the graduate education and associate professor at ISU's Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication, also interim director of the Women's and Gender Studies program there. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Ben.
Join our conversation a little bit later in the hour as we discuss the criminal prosecutions of Donald Trump. Of course, not a week goes by without developments on those many fronts, the court calendar colliding with the campaign calendar, as we have, I think, 222 days before the general election in November. Not that anyone's counting. I guess I just did. We'll also talk about the aftermath of another near government shutdown last Friday on the weekend. The UN Security Council calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. Those unfounded claims by Vladimir Putin of Russia that jihadists were helped by Western and Ukraine intelligence. Also, Liz Cheney in Iowa today, speaking at Drake this evening, gives us an opportunity to talk about her legacy, have Wayne and Kelly chime in on their thoughts on what she represents on our political landscape now, quite a long time after January 6th, and the hearings that she co-chaired as well. Let's start off with what's been happening in the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court yesterday, it seems, according to reports, unlikely to roll back access to a key abortion drug. Justices, according to reports, sounding skeptical that the anti-abortion doctors challenging access to this drug, mifepristone, a drug used in more than 60% of U.S. abortions, had legal grounds to sue. Justices will rule by early July on whether this pill can continue to be sent by mail, prescribed without an in-person visit, and used in up to 10 weeks into the presidency, the pregnancy, excuse me. Well, let's listen to Justice Gorsuch, a nominee of President Donald Trump. He joined Justice Jackson, a nominee of President Biden, in emphasizing that the Supreme Court often says its ruling should address the legal harm at issue and go no further.
We have before us a handful of individuals who have asserted a conscience objection. Normally, we would allow a equitable relief to address them. Recently, I think what Justice Jackson's alluding to, we've had, one might call it a rash of universal injunctions or vacatures. And this case seems like a prime example of turning what could be a small lawsuit into a nationwide legislative assembly on an FDA rule or any other federal government action.
Kelly Winfrey, as someone who studies political communications and gender studies, your thoughts on how this particular Supreme Court case over medical abortion fits into the larger context in the debate over reproductive rights, health care, ever since the overturning of Roe v. Wade in 2022?
Yeah, well, the availability of mifepristone has been an important tool for women who are seeking abortion, particularly in states where access is difficult or illegal. And so, you know, that having that drug available is really important. As you mentioned, it's about 60% of abortions are performed using a medical means or the mifepristone pill. The thing about this case that I think is interesting and probably kind of goes along with the piece you played just a second ago is that the court seems to be focusing on on whether or not the folks who brought this claim have the legal standing to do so. The group of doctors, the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, challenged this ruling that the FDA had allowed mifepristone to be distributed by mail. This started during the pandemic. and then was continued. So you don't have to have an in-person doctor visit, and you can receive the prescription by mail. And as you mentioned, use it up to 10 weeks of pregnancy. The group that brought this case claimed that that the FDA had failed to address safety concerns of the drug, which then could result in a patient being given the pill that caused something bad to happen, and they had to go to an ER, and a doctor who opposed abortion would be forced to participate in the procedure. And it sounds like what the court is doing is, instead of ruling about whether or not the drug is safe, or the FDA was able to do that, the question is whether or not someone can challenge the FDA's ruling, which I think is really important, because the precedent that that would set could be very dangerous, right? If you have organizations that disagree with any sort of medication able to challenge its availability for all people, that could be a very problematic precedent. But also, I think it kind of signals the court wants to stay out of any more of the abortion debate. Well, some of the court anyway. I mean, Thomas and Alito said some interesting things related to Comstock laws. So that was a odd history note for folks.
Yeah. Four of the nine justices who heard that the oral arguments yesterday on this challenge to the abortion drug are women. Kelly, that is the highest number ever to sit on the high court for an abortion case. Do you think that made a big difference here?
I mean, you know, I think it representation always makes a difference because you have folks with different perspective. Obviously, not all four of those women are pro-choice. Amy Coney Barrett is very adamantly pro-life. But her questioning was along similar lines of the legal standing. But I do think it's important that we have those women there. It does beg the question, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg always said that when there were nine, there would be enough women on the Supreme Court. And I think that raises an important point that most of history and most of the decisions about reproductive rights that have gone to the Supreme Court have been made largely by men.
Yeah.
And we have at least a little bit more representation in this case.
Yeah. Kelly, I wonder if you can comment on how women and men tend to see this issue, reproductive health, differently. Is the split really between men and women, or more, well, depending on which major party you belong to?
There is a significant partisan difference. Democrats are much more likely to be pro-choice. However, there's a large proportion of Republican voters, men and women, who support some level of access to abortion. That number is a little bit higher with Republican women than Republican men, but it's still a majority of folks support access to abortion. Now, that, you know, there's a spectrum of full access at all times and all instances to some restrictions to no abortion. But as we've seen in some of the redder states who have taken this to a ballot issue, mm-hmm. Kansas is a good example. Overwhelmingly, the support is to maintain some level of access. So I think it's wise for the court to stay out of this, the part yeah. that's very partisan.
Yeah, and specific to Iowa, Kelly, we don't know if Iowa's ban on most abortions after about 6 weeks of pregnancy will be upheld by the Iowa
right.
Supreme Court, do we? That would be a big change for women here in Iowa, where abortion is currently legal up to about 20 weeks of pregnancy, right?
Yes, but still, you know, relatively difficult to access. And that's where the option for medical abortions and telehealth visits become even more important. We've ran Planned Parenthood and other organizations out of the state as much as as some conservatives have mm-hmm. Have tried. So access is still difficult. So I think that's why this question is so important.
Right. But these medications can be accessed across state lines, right, Kelly?
Correct. Yes,
yeah.
Correct.
So
you could visit a doctor through telehealth and, you know, in Illinois, and then they can mail you the prescription. And you can do a medical abortion at home.
Mm-hmm. To you, Wayne, the political implications of this as a larger issue in this election year, I noticed that Mary Lands, her name, a Democrat, won a special election yesterday for a state house seat in Alabama after campaigning on access to abortion and in vitro fertilization. So we still, and the Biden administration touting that as a sign of the continued political potency of reproductive rights here. Wayne, what do you see here in the year 2024? We know that Democrats used it successfully in 2022. What do you think the current state of that as a weighty political issue is in deciding voters' minds?
Well, I think it still is an important issue, and I think the Democrats will be using it. We'll see in the election just how effective it is, but I think this case, the situation comes along and, in such a way that it helps the Democrats. A couple things related to that. One thing is what you're really talking about here is the power of the FDA to regulate drugs. And do you want the court to make decisions in terms of the safety of drugs? That's one issue. And then there's another issue is the harm to physicians that is alleged by the defense or the people who are making the case is almost hypothetical.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so clear that anybody's going to be harmed by this.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting that when you are an emergency room doctor, there are, I think, hospital policies that would take into account the hypothetical that this court was considering, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Kelly, before we go to break, we have about a minute before we go to break. What do you see next for anti-abortion activists if, as reports seem to indicate, that this case will be decided unlikely to roll back access to this abortion drug?
I mean, I would expect there will be continued challenges to providing access, particularly in states that have made it illegal or very difficult. So whether it's, this will help the next group hone their argument or provide a better test case. And as Wayne said, this was a hypothetical. And I believe one of the justices yesterday mentioned, where's your case? Where's your example of when this has happened? Because there are other measures in place. So I think this will help people figure out what to do the next time if they're seeking more restrictions.
Mm-hmm. Kelly Winfrey is with us of Iowa State University, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College. You can join our conversation 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We'll talk about the former president being hit with a limited gag order ahead of his hush money trial when we return.
Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org. This IPR podcast is supported by Cultivating Compassion, the Dr. Richard Deming Foundation, fostering causes that enrich the community, generate understanding, and cultivate compassion, including Above and Beyond Cancer.
You've caught us midstream on this edition of River to River from IPR News. Ben Kiefer with the Politics Wednesday edition of our program. Kelly Winfrey of Iowa State University, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College. Join us 1-866-780-9100 or email rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Yesterday, former President Trump hit with a limited gag order ahead of his hush money trial. The former president can't talk about witnesses. Can't talk about prosecutors or potential jurors who will be part of the trial starting April 15th in New York. Why the gag order? Well, we know the former president is known for making false claims about people he disagrees with. In fact, hours before the order was issued yesterday, he attacked the judge's daughter on social media. April 15th, the start of the first criminal trial of a former U.S. president, something historic there. This is the New York case, that one of four criminal prosecutions that the former president faces. The other ones, the one in Georgia state court, two federal cases, one in Florida, one in Washington. Trump has pleaded not guilty to all of them. All of them have been delayed. We've been hearing about it in our news to varying degrees for various reasons. As Donald Trump runs for president for the third time. Wayne, to you first on this, the significance first in the news here that case moving forward, it will start unless something gets in the way, April 15th, right? The first criminal trial of a former U.S. president.
Yeah, I think the most significant thing about this is that it's pretty clear now that the case will start in April. And Trump will still try to delay it, but every time that meets opposition and his opposition is overcome, it becomes harder to delay it further.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of this case compared to the other case, this hush money case?
Well, this is probably the weakest overall case, and most insignificant. I mean, classified documents and January 6th are really major issues, trying to subvert the election results are huge issues. This is much smaller, but this one is most likely to come to trial. I really worry whether any of the others can come to trial or be finished before the election. And then if Trump is elected, it's not clear that any of them will go further if they haven't already been decided.
Mm-hmm. Kelly, your thoughts on this case that concerns hush money payments to the adult film star Stormy Daniels?
This is probably one of the less significant criminal charges that Trump is facing, but one of many, and likely to move forward before the election perhaps conclude. I think, you know, what's interesting or challenging is that we are in uncharted territory of what this means for a presidential candidate. Mm-hmm. The gag order, you know, it's not the first time there's been a gag order on Trump with a case, but his ability to talk about this on the campaign trail is limited in order for there to be a fair trial. But he will obviously, and I think already has spun this as a case to hurt his chances of winning elections. So it all feeds into his campaign's narrative that there are people out to get him. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, they should still support him. I mean, you know, there's a lot of question of whether this will have an effect on the outcome of the election. I doubt that it does. There's been a lot of polling around it, but mostly Republicans have said that it would have no impact if he were convicted of any of these crimes. It would have no impact, or they might even be more likely to support him. So it probably doesn't have an impact in that way. There's a lot of charges out there, so yeah. I guess we'll see what happens.
It seems to be helping with his popularity with some groups to show himself as an embattled person here in the courts. Seems to have helped his fundraising, some mm-hmm. of which is going to his legal defense. I noticed in related news, Donald Trump announced a new money-making venture, a God Bless the USA Bible, to raise some money. Wayne, weigh in on what Kelly just mentioned there. We've asked it many times over the preceding months. Any signs that Donald Trump's legal woes impacting the support among his voters or are likely to in the future?
I would agree with Kelly. It's unlikely to affect his voters, but he needs more than his voters to win the presidential election. And there's even a significant part of the Republican Party who voted for Nikki Haley in the primaries. And I'm not sure that this is going to help get those people. These cases are going to help get those people to support Trump and make it more likely, I think, that they will not vote at all. Conceivably, some of them vote for Biden.
Yeah. And it's interesting to think in the coming months, we'll just have a split screen, Trump in court, Trump on the campaign trail, right? Wayne, this is just, as stated earlier, uncharted territory.
No, that's right. And he himself is going to have to spend a lot of time in the courtroom, which limits his ability to hold rallies at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about what happened last Friday into the weekend. President Biden on Saturday signing a $1.2 trillion package of spending bills. This after Congress passed the long overdue legislation just hours earlier, ending the threat of yet another partial government shutdown. This will fund the government through September, a package with wins for both Republicans and Democrats, lawmakers, still have to decide on funding for Ukraine, also for Israel. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene filed a motion to vacate Speaker of the House Mike Johnson. So the vote here in the House, 286 to 134, the Senate vote, 74 to 74. So heavy margins in both chambers. Representative Randy Feenstra of Iowa's 4th District, the sole member of our 6-member congressional delegation to vote no for this. Wayne, your thoughts on this? Yet another near government shutdown averted and the package that was passed.
Yeah, I think the most significant thing that comes across to me on this is it is now very clear that the Republicans cannot pass anything in the House of Representatives without Democratic support. And now that their majority is reduced to just two people, that between now and November, anything that passes the House will have to have Democratic support, I think. I think the other thing is avoiding the shutdown is going to save the government a lot of money because after the shutdown, they'd have to pay all the costs of expenses and all that were and salaries and all that were incurred during the shutdown.
Yeah, Wayne, and we also, I think you referenced it. So we have a Wisconsin Republican, Mike Gallagher, said on Friday he's going to resign the House, leaving House Republicans with that ever so even thinner majority, I guess because of the timing of his leaving his post, there will not be a special election to fill Gallagher's seat here. So putting the Speaker Johnson, yeah, as you said, Wayne, depending more and more on Democratic votes here. When we think about the how productive this Congress has been so far since the last election, since being seated, Wayne, what conclusions do you come to?
Well, it's not been very productive at all. On the other hand, it's the government is still going ahead. We did avert the shutdown. The big open question is still whether this Congress and whether Mike Johnson will bring the aid to Ukraine and Israel to the floor after the Easter break. He seems to want to bring it to the floor. And clearly there's some Republican support for it. But Johnson himself's position will be weakened in the Republicans if he does bring it forward. So it's not altogether clear to me at this stage exactly what will happen.
Mm-hmm. Kelly Winfrey, your thought on this aversion and this averted partial shutdown?
Well, you know, it's good they averted a shutdown, but they just kicked the can down the road until a little closer to the election.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
I imagine we'll be having these same conversations then. You know, I think it's nice in a world where you have some bipartisan support on bills. Ideally, that's what should be happening in the legislature. And so that spending package that gave wins to both sides, I think in some ways showed the compromise is possible. But, you know, as we've seen on most issues, it's going to be very difficult for Republicans to get anything passed. Losing Mike Gallagher, you know, he's in a safe Republican district, but that brings their majority to 217 to 213 Democrats. So it'll make things very difficult, which I imagine will be part of the conversation in the general election about whether or not Republicans should maintain their slim control if they can't get anything done.
Mm-hmm. Wayne, Kevin McCarthy, we know, was ousted. Speaker Johnson, likely to be ousted, not likely. We have the move by Marjorie Taylor Greene to file a motion to vacate the Speaker of the House. Any mood for that, you sense?
I think it's less likely. Throwing out two speakers of the House in one Congress, I think would work against the Republicans in November. The other thing I think is significant, the Democrats want to get the Ukraine-Israel aid bill through. And they may well, if the Republicans go ahead with this, may well support keeping Mike Johnson on as Speaker simply because of the priority which they're giving to the aid package that Biden wants to get through.
Mm-hmm. As I said, wins here for both Republicans and Democrats. For the Republicans, they are touting an increase in the number of ICE detention beds and border agents, cutting funding to NGOs. Also, in one of the smaller provisions here, preventing the Consumer Product Safety Commission from banning gas stoves. The Democrats in this package praising the $1 billion increase for child care and early learning programs, including $12 billion for the Head Start program. Another provision here, and this dovetails into talking more about the war in Gaza, the measure that would halt funding for UNWRA. This is the UN agency that provides aid to Palestinians. We had the Senate, as I mentioned, approving the appropriations bill by a large margin, but independent U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont voting no because the bill stripped funding from this UN agency.
Tens of thousands of people are starving. UNRWA is trying to feed them, and the Israeli government and its allies like AIPAC spend much of their time lobbying to defund UNRWA, the major organization which is feeding starving people. Sadly, tragically, many members of Congress seem to be happy to be part of this starvation caucus.
Now, Israel has accused 12 of UNRWA's thousands of employees of participating in the October 7th Hamas attacks on Israel that killed 1,200 people, 250 others taken hostages. The U.S., other countries as well, suspending aid to that organization. The U.N. has launched investigations into that, and we're watching the NPR reporting on that. So Wayne, talk a little bit about how the funding for this UN agency has fit in to the debate over this larger in Congress.
There are a couple of things I would say here. One is there isn't really an alternative to this agency at the moment. That's a problem. The other thing that I think relates to is this issue of aid to the Palestinians has become important both in Israeli politics and in U.S. politics. And the Netanyahu government with a right wing, which is at least at some levels wants to reoccupy the Gaza Strip, is keeping Netanyahu from making any concessions. And Biden now has to worry about the Palestinian-American vote and the progressive vote, and that's driving them further and further apart on all of the issues related to Gaza and Israel, and it's going to make it very, very hard to reach agreement.
Mm-hmm. The UN Security Council calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. This for the first time after the U.S. did not veto the measure. This is a shift, Wayne, in its previous position. Explain this shift. What's going into it?
Well, it's not really a shift in a policy sense. The U.S. is still supporting Israel and will continue to support Israel. But the U.S. is now no longer blocking a Security Council resolution, which puts a burden on Israel if it doesn't conform to the resolution. And I think that's what's antagonizing Netanyahu. And of course, for his political base, he cannot give in to what the Security Council wants to do.
Mm-hmm. Kelly, I want to go to you for the domestic implications of this debate over Gaza and the split within the Democratic Party over it. We had President Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris speaking in North Carolina yesterday, a group of pro-Palestinian activists interrupting the president while he talked about his record on health care. Let's listen to a few moments of this.
A patient with a heart disease, diabetes, or a child with asthma couldn't get coverage. Why? Because the insurance company considered those a pre-existing condition. that allowed them to deny coverage. Everybody deserves health care. Be patient with them. They have a point. We need to get a lot more care into the Gaza.
President Biden being interrupted yesterday in North Carolina by protesters. Kelly, as someone who studies political communication, tell us what you see going on here.
Well, I think Biden's doing what he needs to do to win, you know, whether we'll put aside the question whether it's good policy or whether you agree or disagree with it. But
I didn't look at the clock. I'm going to put you on hold, Kelly. I'm sorry about that. We'll be back in just a moment to get Kelly's response there. Kelly Winfrey of Iowa State University, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College. You know, time just slips by when you're talking politics. Sometimes you need to look up at the clock once in a while. We'll be back in just a moment with more River to River from IPR News.
This IPR podcast is supported by Cultivating Compassion, the Dr. Richard Deming Foundation, fostering causes that enrich the community, generate understanding, and cultivate compassion, including Above and Beyond Cancer.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, Kelly Winfrey of Iowa State University. Join us 1-866-780-9100 or River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Before the break, Kelly had just started with her thoughts on how much of a factor the war in Gaza has been, and how much the split within the Democratic Party has shifted Biden's response to what Israel is doing in response to that attack on October 7th. Kelly.
Yeah, there was a recent Gallup poll that found that the majority of independents and Democrats disapprove of Israeli action in Gaza. So the support for the Israeli government is less than it has been when the conflict started. And as you've seen with that protest and some of the comments from other members of Congress, there has been criticism that there is not enough, or that there's too much support for Israel and not enough support for the Palestinian people. So I think that in terms of the campaign, Biden's trying to really please all of the Democrats.
Is that possible?
Never. It's never possible.
No, it's a big tent.
But trying not to take a side. So another poll I saw had found that the majority of Democrats and independents felt that the U.S. should not take a side. So they shouldn't just back Israel or just back Palestine. And that seems to be more what's happening. By abstaining from the U.N. vote, it was, just not taking a side, more or less. And I think that's more likely to please folks who might be voting in the general election. However, foreign affairs issues don't typically have a huge impact on presidential elections, excluding when the U.S. is involved in a conflict, like Iraq in 2004. But I think in this case, it probably won't swing a lot of voters, but it could depress turnout from some more progressive voters if Biden is perceived as too pro-Israel. Mm-hmm. Now, on the other hand, Trump's very pro-Israel, too. So, not sure you're doing yourself any favors by staying home.
Join us 1-866-780-9100. Let's check in with Floyd calling from Ottumwa. Hi, Floyd. Welcome to the program.
Yes. Wayne and Kelly, you'll recall in 1967, we had a USS Liberty, an American Navy ship that was attacked while in international waters by Israeli aircraft and motor torpedo boats. Now, Kelly and Wayne, you'll recall that attack went on for hours. We had over 30 U.S. sailors killed in that attack. What's going to happen when we get something like that? Because we're going to get involved more substantially militarily here. What's going to happen when that happens again? Let me take your answer off the air, your comments, please. Thank you.
Thanks, Floyd. So the main question there, will this expand? Will U.S. troops be involved, Wayne? What are your thoughts here?
I do not think U.S. troops are likely to be involved. I think Biden has made that pretty clear. U.S. aircraft may well be involved. They are involved already in Yemen. But I don't think U.S. troops. The only parallel I could see is somebody trying to attack U.S. ships off the Israel coast. I think that's unlikely because all the ships that are there are well protected by the planes from the aircraft carriers and from the missiles that American ships have.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to where to that attack in Russia on Friday. Russia saying that 139 people killed when four armed men burst into the Crocus City concert complex Friday evening. Top Russian officials have accused Ukraine and the West of being involved in that deadly attack. After it was claimed that by the Islamic State that they were responsible for it, IS, the Islamic State, has released a video of the atrocity, but Vladimir Putin and allies to him have claimed jihadists were helped by Western and Ukrainian intelligence. Ukraine has rejected Russia's lies. There doesn't seem to be any evidence for what Putin is claiming here. The U.S. has said IS is solely to blame for the attack. France's Emmanuel Macron saying it would be both cynical and counterproductive for Russia to try to exploit the situation to turn it against Ukraine. Wayne, first of all, what do you make of Putin's assertions here of responsibility?
Well, I think the important thing here is Putin's overall narrative these days, which is that the West is out to destroy Russia, sort of the Cold War all over again. It's an existential fight between the West and Russia. And what I think he's doing here is taking this situation and looking for some way to put it in this existential struggle. And alleging the United States and Ukraine were involved does allow him to fit it into this narrative of his, perhaps strengthening his ability for repression at home. I would add one other thing. We warned, as best I can tell, Russia in advance that something like this was coming, and they were unable to react to it, given their own concern with domestic security.
Yeah. Perhaps, Wayne, you can share a little bit more about why Russia would be the target of the Islamic State here overall.
I think this goes back to Syria and the civil war that took place there in the earlier part of this century. And the bombings that the Syrian government did on the Arabs that were living in Syria. And ISIS came out of all of that. And Russia came to the aid of the Syrian government. And in some ways, this is getting back at Russia for its involvement in Syria.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to a visit tonight by attorney and former U.S. Representative Liz Cheney, speaking in Des Moines tonight, for the Spring Buxbaum Lecture at Drake University. It's called An Evening with Liz Cheney, starting at 7 p.m. tonight at the Knapp Center on the Drake University campus. Of course, she held the third highest position in the House Republican leadership once upon a time, an outspoken conservative against former President Donald Trump, serving on the White House committee to investigate the January 6th insurrection. She was censured for her involvement, eventually ousted in a Republican primary in Wyoming. Let's listen to Liz Cheney. This is during a hearing in June of 2022, offering a stark message to members of her party who continued to support former President Donald Trump and downplay the events of January 6th.
Country, we don't swear an oath to an individual or a political party. We take our oath to defend the United States Constitution. And that oath must mean something. Tonight, I say this to my Republican colleagues who are defending the indefensible. There will come a day when Donald Trump is gone, but your dishonor will remain. As Americans, we all have a duty to ensure that what happened on January 6th never happens again, to set aside partisan battles, to stand together to perpetuate and preserve our great republic.
Kelly, start us off with your thoughts on Liz Cheney speaking in Iowa, her legacy, how she may be seen when the political history of this time is written.
Well, I think that history will judge her well for standing up for democracy and being willing to challenge Donald Trump. Despite the cost, I think that she knew that she would probably lose that seat if she spoke out against Trump and served on the January 6th committee. So I think in that way, I think history will judge her well, but I guess that might depend on the state of our country and who is writing the history books. I think that she's an important person to look to right now as we think about the direction of the Republican Party. Is this Trump's party? Is this still an independent party that can be led by anyone? I think her being forced out kind of showed that it's currently Trump's party, but we'll see how things go. I'm curious to see, who shows up to see her tonight. And, she's very unpopular among some Republicans in Iowa who are, big Trump supporters. So I think it's an interesting choice, but a good choice to show that there's kind of a middle ground and a moderate Republican voice that still exists.
Kelly, I wonder, as someone who studies gender studies, does her gender play any role in her political rise and her fate in a world where Donald Trump seems to own the GOP these days?
Well, certainly, misogyny is still alive and well, and there's been a fair amount of research that has shown that there's a large amount of sexism among Trump supporters. So I would expect that she has, I know that she has faced attacks and criticism based on her gender to discredit her. However, I do think as a woman standing up against a powerful person and kind of institution that is the Trump Make America Great group is important leadership to see from a woman in the Republican Party, because women are not as well represented in the Republican Party. So I think her voice is even more important because of that lack of representation.
Wayne, how do you view Liz Cheney's legacy?
I think we'll know more after the election in November. but I think what's important here is about 25% of the GOP is not happy with Trump. And he needs those people to vote for him if he has any chance of winning the election. And her speaking out at this stage of the game may be important in what these people decide to do. So I would focus on her potential influence, not on the Trump base, but Republicans who are not happy, which is a minority, to be sure, with Trump.
Yeah, right. And we saw that in the primary just concluded with Nikki Haley's voters. So, Wayne, the question remains, what will the Nikki Haley voters do, right? Stay home,
yes, and
switch to Biden, or support Trump?
I think it's unclear. Some of them will support Trump. Some of them will stay home. Some of them may vote for Biden. I don't think we have very accurate percentages at this stage, but Trump needs to get the majority of them.
Yeah.
To win.
Kelly, what are your thoughts about those who supported Nikki Haley and where they find themselves now?
Yeah, I think it's hard to say what will happen with those voters. I agree with Wayne. There'll probably be some that fall into each camp. I think it's important for Biden to really try to mobilize those folks to come vote for him. I imagine a fair number of them voted for him in 2020. So getting those people to vote for him again is important for him to reach those numbers. But yes, if Trump can't pull the Republicans, especially Republicans that are loyal enough to show up in caucus or vote in a primary, then he's going to have a hard time winning the general election as well.
Mm-hmm. We just had a new release from the Iowa GOP. I'll quote this. The Iowa GOP chairman, Jeff Kaufman, releasing this statement in response to former Congresswoman Liz Cheney's lecture at Drake University tonight. Quote, "It's telling that Liz Cheney feels more at home on a liberal college campus than meeting with Iowans in the true heart of our state after being soundly rejected by her own voters." And continuing with this statement from Iowa GOP chair Jeff Kaufman, "Cheney has done nothing but deceitfully push an agenda, tear at the fabric of our party, and alienate GOP members. The only people who listen to Liz Cheney are woke liberals who were the ones leading the charge against her father a few decades ago. What a joke." So there's some political communication to respond to, Kelly. Huh?
I wish you could see my eyes roll on the radio, but I think, you know, that just doesn't do any good for anybody. She's a guest speaker. I work at Iowa State. We have guest speakers across the political spectrum. I think in any state, you'd want to have folks come speak to our citizens, our community from a variety of backgrounds. And, attacking her like that just seems petty to me. You don't have to agree with her. And I think it's important. You know, he is right. There's a lot of folks that think that she did the honorable thing here, but disagree with her on a lot of issues, wanted her father to not be in the White House, even as vice president. But what that shows is that people are complex and politics is complex. It's not an all or nothing, right? You can say, I agree with you here, but I disagree with you there. And honestly, that's a big part of the problem of where our politics are. We can't come to any agreements because we've decided it's all or nothing.
Mm-hmm. Kelly, we have a minute or so left. What do you have your eyes on looking forward here? We have plenty of the political season, plenty of this election campaign ahead of us. But what in particular are you focusing on?
No, I think we'll really be focusing on what's going on in some key states, particularly, the ones where we had conflict last time around: Georgia, Arizona, Nevada, Pennsylvania. Probably some Wisconsin and Michigan as well, to see, how things might turn out. I always want to remind people that national polls don't mean anything, right? We don't have a popular vote election. So if you're looking at polling, you should be looking at what's going on in those swing states.
But we do see that Donald Trump has also a lead, according to the polls, in those swing states, don't we, Kelly?
And yeah, in some of them, and it's still pretty early to see. I think there's, it's just such a bizarre time to live in, where we have, someone who's facing all these criminal charges. We have the oldest candidates, running for office, a lot of voters that don't want to vote for either of them. So it's really hard to figure out what's going to happen. I think independents, particularly independents that are on the more progressive side, will be important if they show up to vote for Biden or decide to stay home because they don't like either option.
Yeah. All right. We've run out of time. Thank you so much for both of your insights. Kelly Winfrey of Iowa State University, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College. Kelly, Wayne, until next time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
Artificial intelligence becoming a transformative force, revolutionizing industries, reshaping our society. Tomorrow on the program, three perspectives on the promise and perils of AI, how it's reshaping journalism. We'll have the co-founder of an AI major at Drake talk about that. Also about an investigation into AI disinformation that started at a small Iowa newspaper tomorrow on the program. Today's program produced by Caitlin Troutman with help from Maddie Willis and Sean McLean. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.